Okay, well, first of all, thank you to the organizers for inviting me. Very happy to have been able to come as well, despite teaching this term. And before I start, let me give credit to people who I've been working with on a number of problems that I'll be discussing today. Alex Mogilner, who was a student at UBC a few years ago and is now a professor at Davis. Magdalena Luca is now in Boston. She was also a PhD student. Alexandra was a postdoc. Gould had been a PhD student a few years earlier, and Ethan had been a PhD student. So I'm going to talk, my title is very presumptuous, but I'm going to give a little bit of a sense of occurrences where you could say that pattern formation or theories thereof have cropped up in things that I've looked at. I have to confess, though, that all the examples that I will give today are a little bit artificial from the biological point of view. They've been either oversimplified or abstracted, so that I would say they're more of interest to mathematicians as I present them today than they are to biologists. So without further ado, let me get started first at the lowest level, the molecular level, in where I would like to discuss. Yeah, that'll probably be better. That's great. Oh, this is good, I think. Okay, great. So first of all, here you're looking at a cell, and we'll be looking at successively bigger views of it, zoomed-in views. This is the nucleus right here. Here it is, top-down view and side view. There's a very thin sheet-like protrusion called the lamellipod. This is essentially the engine that drives the cell forward. Now, when you zoom in on a portion of that flat sheet-like object, what you see inside the cell is a weave of molecules collectively known as the cytoskeleton, and these are composed, among other things, of actin, which is a fiber, a biopolymer. Here's a schematic view of what the front edge of that sheet-like surface looks like. And here's, again, these polymers called actin. Now, I've worked a fair bit on that problem, and I will present only one of many aspects that I've found to be interesting today. So it's been noticed in certain micrographs of this protein in the cell that the fibers aren't just oriented randomly. It seems that there are some preferred directions along which they're oriented. So this is out of a paper by Malley and Borisy, where they've actually shown that there are filaments are predominantly at something like 35 degrees to the front edge, approximately. So one question of interest has been, what is it that might cause these type of angle or orientation selection in polymers? Now, I've worked initially with Gould and later with Alex Mogilner on a variety of models for associations of filaments, such as actin filaments. Today I will discuss only this one question of how one might account for preferred orientations, but what I'll discuss really applies more in vivo than in a living cell. So the question is how spontaneous formation of alignment to one direction or another might take place. The reason I want to present this model here is because it is connected with a rather simple but yet interesting non-local type of integral PDE model. So let me say a little bit first about what I mean by non-local models. These are models in which you've got some kind of interactions that occur over an extended range, not just locally. And you can see why when you talk about interactions of filaments that are at some angle with each other, as far as angle space, they can interact even if they're not at the same or close angles. So a filament at some orientation, theta prime, can cause another filament to rotate and align and bind to it. And in the case of actin, this could be mediated by cross-linkers or proteins that actually bundle or tie the filaments together. Now, in general, in non-local integral PDE-type models, one often encounters terms which include convolutions, and the particular equation that I'll be interested in is of this sort, where there's a convolution sitting here. Let me explain why that actually crops up. And this, by the way, acts as the velocity, or a term like the convective velocity. In this case, it would be in the angle space. So if you think of A theta T as describing the density of filaments at some angle, where that angle, of course, goes from minus pi to pi, then you can convince yourself that if you just think of rotation of filaments, both random rotation and rotation mediated by interactions, you can come up with a very simple-looking equation that describes redistribution of filaments in angle. Now, all of the interesting stuff happens with this term right here. This is where filaments are actually interacting with each other, and that may be angle-dependent. So the kernel that sits here, basically what this is representing is the rotational velocity of a filament at one angle induced by a filament at some other angle. The kernel has to have certain properties for this to make physical sense. First of all, it's 2 pi periodic, but also it has to be odd. And the argument for that is a very simple symmetry argument, that if you've got an angle you're attracted to over here, you tend to rotate in a different sense than if you've got a neighbor at the exactly negative equal angle to it. So the sense of rotation is opposite, so K has to be odd. Now, what is this kernel? Well, it's fairly abstract in this model, but you can think of it as the effect of other proteins that interact with actin filaments and cause them to bundle. So wherever that kernel K is negative, what that means is you've got attraction, provided where it's negative for positive angles. Where it's positive, it means you're being repelled from certain angles. Now, it's simple to see that an equation one has a very clear-cut, simple, constant, homogeneous, steady state. And then it's interesting to ask under what cases that steady state is unstable and what happens as a result. Let me just mention that I said that cross-linkers interact with actin, and it's known that a variety of different cross-linkers mediate preferred angles of two filaments that could be either 90, around 90 degrees, 70 degrees, and so on. So all these details would enter into some kind of realistic representation of the kernel. Now, a simple linear stability analysis of this equation goes as follows. Because A is odd and periodic, the fact that it's odd leads us to be able to represent it by its Fourier sine series without loss of generality. The other part of the series will drop out. Let's think of a perturbation which consists of this nth mode and look and ask whether or not it can grow, whether lambda, the eigenvalue, can be positive. The linearized equation shown here, when you plug this in, leads to a kind of condition which directly gives us the stability. Whenever lambda is greater or smaller than zero, you've got stability for all modes, and that happens wherever kn is greater than zero, and when lambda is greater than zero, you've got instability, provided both of these two inequalities are satisfied. So let's look at just one representative example, which is not necessarily chosen for its realism, but just to give a flavor of the kinds of results one could get. So here is an example where I've chosen a kind of sawtooth kernel, which has got compact support on minus pi over 2 to pi over 2. And really what this means is filaments are repelling at small angles. So if they're too close together, they repel each other, but they do not interact if they are at angles larger than 90 degrees. This function has a simple Fourier sine series, which is why I chose it as an example. And the instability condition turns out to be something of this form, and this is first satisfied for mode n equals 4. But only provided the diffusion, the random rotation of the filaments, divided by the level, the homogeneous steady state level, is less than some constant. So, for example, if you decrease the rate of random rotation, or you increase the level of filaments in your system, then it's more likely that this can be satisfied. And when that's satisfied, you would then get 4 preferred orientations. On the other hand, if we look at something very similar, but just simply the negative, so it also shares a similar Fourier sine series, but without that minus, this then represents a kernel in which filaments attract each other when they're at small angles, so they tend to bundle. And in that case, this instability condition is first satisfied when n equals 2 for mode 2. And that's true provided that the random rotation divided by the level of the filaments is not too large, smaller than some constant. So in that case, you have the appearance of 2 preferred angles. Okay, so that gives a basic idea of how that goes. Let me indicate that there's quite a bit of related work that was done by students, by other people, by some folks that were in Bonn in Germany that we talked to. And so, for example, that very simple model that I've discussed, some explicit solutions can be found for special kernels. The shape and width of the peaks that you get, we've discussed that in a paper with Mogilner. There were quite a number of generalizations of this very simple model in which you've basically got gradual rotation into an angle to models that include jumps from one orientation rapidly to another. There were a variety of other kernels in which the dependence is not simply the difference of the two angles. And there are also spatio-angular models that we've explored over time. Now, with all that said, I should be completely honest that this model does not describe the way that actin aligns in a real cell. We know a lot more about what takes place in a cell, and it's certainly not that filaments are simply orienting and tumbling in the cell. What really happens is the filaments branch off of one another, grow, are capped. They are very much influenced by where they are in the cell, so the process is much more complicated. What I've described maybe could take place in a test tube if you added filaments and crosslinkers. So some open problems include how to model real actin orientation selection and include all these various interesting processes. Some steps along that way have been made by Malley and Borisy in a recent paper. All right, that gives a flavor of the molecular scale that I wanted to present. So on up one higher level of hierarchy into the cellular level, and here again is a problem that was motivated by a biological subject that we were looking at, but spun off let's say, a model that has some perhaps more interesting mathematical phenomena that crop up. So this has to do with Alzheimer's disease, in which these aggregates called senile plaques are formed in the brain of Alzheimer's sufferers. In fact, let me just show this for a minute. This shows a rough distribution of such plaques, and they tend to be highly concentrated in the hippocampus. A single plaque looks something like this. There's a very dense aggregate of a certain kind of cell in the middle called microglia, and it's surrounded by dead and stressed neurons. These microglia get into this area by a process known as chemotaxis. They are attracted towards this site. And before I take this off, let me also point out that there's a certain distribution of plaques. This is one typical image of post-mortem tissue in which those plaques have been stained. So you can see that there's a certain distribution, and on average they tend to be roughly 100 microns apart, give or take. Now, we were interested in characterizing how these form, and we looked at this process from a rather detailed biological point of view, where, among other things, we tried to take into account different populations of cells that can undergo motion in the brain. Basically, these are like the immune-type cells resident in the brain. They react to any kind of stress or stimuli or damage by coming to the site and doing their thing, removing debris or secreting chemicals that call other cells in, and so forth. So we had other models that dealt with this whole panoply of phenomena, but what I'd like to present today is a very simple, abstract, mathematical model that was motivated by this. Basically, one of the students had to get a math PhD, so we had to do something that was a little bit more, can be thought of as, you know, mathematical treatment. So this work was joint with Magdalena Luca, who did her PhD on this, Alexandra, Alex, and it's appeared quite recently, so if you're interested, you can have a look at it. Before I launch into it, let me quickly review a classic model that many people in the audience may be familiar with, which is a Keller-Siegel chemotaxis model. So back in the 70s, Keller and Siegel were modeling the aggregation of a kind of social amoeba, which I've tried to represent by these dots down here. They dealt with Dictyostelium discoideum, also known by the name of slime molds. And in this system, it's known that when the cells are starved, they tend to aggregate and form clusters. And the process by which they do this is they secrete a chemical called a chemoattractant, and then they undergo chemotaxis towards that chemical. So this pair of equations has been studied by many people. M is the density of cells, C is the density of a chemical produced by those cells, generally speaking. The cells undergo random motion with motility coefficient mu. They undergo chemotaxis, as modeled by this term. So they generally move up a gradient of chemical with some coefficient, chemotactic coefficient chi. The terms F and G refer to kinetics of cell division and growth and of the production and decay of the chemicals. And this model has been studied in the literature by many people. So let me give you just an example of numerous people who have studied these. F and G, these two columns here, refer to the cell kinetics and the chemical kinetics, respectively. So here's just a partial list of the different types of kinetics that have been looked at. Philip Maney has also done quite a bit of work on these kind of systems and variants thereof. So a lot is known about chemotaxis models. We put a slight twist on it in that we looked at a model in which there's both chemoattraction and chemorepulsion. We had some circumstantial evidence that there were certain cytokines, chemicals secreted by microglia, that act as chemorepellents and others that act as chemoattractants. But I'm not going to swear before you that that's precisely firmly established in biological fact. In any case, we looked at a simple one-dimensional model with domain length L, in which we've got three equations. One is the typical chemotaxis equation for the cells. Here there are two equations for two chemicals. One refers to C1 is the attractant, and C2 is the repellent. And notice that in the chemotaxis term, cells are attracted to chemical 1, but repelled from chemical 2. Also notice that the cells are secreting both types of chemicals. Indeed, it is known that microglia do secrete many, many different kinds of chemicals that are reactive and that are can stimulate other cells. This was modeled together with no flux boundary conditions in a simple 1D domain. Let me point out that the various parameters sitting here, B and D, for the chemicals define a certain kind of chemical range or length scale for each of the two substances. You can think of this combination as the range of the attractant, spatial range, and of this as the spatial range of the repellent. So, with that in mind, one can study the system in a variety of ways. Here's the full dimensionless system where some rescaling has been done. This is the parameter that is basically the ratio of the ranges of attraction to repulsion. Repulsion to attraction. And this is the magnitude, roughly speaking, of the attraction divided by repulsion. Now, we were interested in particular with the case where the chemicals diffuse much faster than the motion of the cells. And in that case, when these epsilons are small, you can derive kind of approximate shadow system, which is very similar to what David Iron and Michael Ward did in a much more elaborate setting. And essentially what that is, let me show you briefly how that goes, but essentially you put these two equations on quasi-steady state, so you assume that the chemicals are equilibrating much faster than the cell motion. You do a simple Green's function solution for the chemicals, and you plug that into your equation for the cells, thereby eliminating the system of, you eliminate two PDEs, but then you get instead an integral PDE with a kernel here that happens to look like this type of difference of exponentials. Notice that there is a similarity with other models that I've discussed previously. Same kind of a structure, only now we've got, actually this should be 0 to L, or you can study it on an infinite domain if you want to, whereas in the actin model, this was periodic. Well, to make a long story short, the results depend on all those dimensionless ratios of attractant to repellent. And I don't think I'll go through the whole stability analysis at this point. Simply, there isn't enough time, and it's probably not too interesting. We analyzed the full system as well as the shadow system. And if you analyze the full system or the other one, whichever, you find that the bottom line is you get a certain condition for instability to wave number Q, where the parameters sitting here are precisely those ratios of magnitudes and of ranges of the two chemicals. And when you look at the parameter plane, see what kind of solutions you get. And this now is the ratio of magnitudes of attraction to repulsion. This is the ratio of range of repulsion to attraction. Then it turns out that there's a certain region in this plane in which you have periodic patterns formed, and in the other regions the homogeneous steady state is stable, or you get some kind of large clusters and no periodicity. Here are also typical solutions that were obtained numerically. It was a bit of a challenge to get numerical solutions simply because these systems are notorious for producing sharp peaks. In fact, in both these pictures, these are shown on a log plot, so the peaks are in fact very, very sharp. And you see both the cells and the chemicals as they're distributed over space. One of the aspects that we tried to make touch base with is the applicability to the original problem that we set out to explore, namely Alzheimer's disease. And because we've been working on generating more detailed simulations, we had some values of parameters pegged down pretty well because we'd been looking through the literature and weeding through. There were a few that we weren't able to find from the literature, but the theory did help to constrain what would their values have to be if we get these spatial distributions of plaques. So, in summary, what did we learn out of this whole problem? And I haven't gone into detail on the analysis. First of all, it definitely comes out that the occurrence at all and types of aggregates as well as their distribution depends on relative magnitudes and ranges of the attraction and repulsion. We get the well-spaced aggregates under particular conditions, namely when you've got short-range attraction and long-range repulsion. We got reasonable agreement with observed plaque spacing, but please take that with a very large grain of salt, because again, this is a quite simple model. And we found that when you increase the density of those cells that are chemo-attracting, you get more closely spaced plaques. So if you've got more cells resident in this region of the brain, then your plaques will be more closely spaced. Okay, so I can't quite read what time it is. 22, okay. So let me also mention what are some open problems and other potential applications of theories like this, or variants thereof. It would be interesting. We've done really only, we've scratched the surface and done the simplest kind of analysis, linear stability analysis, which I know for Michael Ward this is sort of like passé. But nevertheless, it at least provokes you into doing other interesting things. So, for example, one might want to ask, can you say something about the shapes of the peaks by doing asymptotics? If you look at some kind of nonlinear or weakly nonlinear stability analysis, can you address how the peaks compete? Because we did often notice in numerical simulations that the initial number of peaks competed so that in the end we only had fewer that persisted in the domain. What's the behavior going to be in a more realistic two- or three-dimensional situation? There are other phenomena that we could look for in these type of models that include both attraction and repulsion, traveling waves, oscillations, and so on. Understanding the interaction of peaks from an analytic point of view would also be, I think, interesting and hopefully doable. The effect of other types of kinetics, because we've assumed really very simple linear kinetic terms in what we looked at. There are other applications of these kind of models. In particular, it's known that when the central nervous system develops, nerve cells secrete a variety of attractants and repellents, semaphorins and netrins, which cue other nerve cells to grow and develop in certain ways. It may also be applicable to some kind of social swarming in bacteria, and whether or not it's relevant in Alzheimer's disease still remains to be established. In particular, is there a characteristic spacing of plaques, and can we really tie it in more closely? Okay, so having given you a flavor of that system, let me go on and describe the next hierarchy, which is a model that arose out of looking at social aggregation. So this was joint with Alex. Leanne Bent and Ethan Spiros were at the time students who did some simulations to back some of this up. This too has appeared recently if you'd like more details. So on my way into the fields today, I crossed by, I think it was Elm and Macaulay, and in fact I saw something much like this. Birds sitting on a wire. This is not the best picture. The ones I saw on Elm Street, they were practically sitting like ducks in a row with nice equal spacings, maybe in groups. But the question is, what is it that governs the spacing behavior in a flock or a group of social organisms? So the question I'm going to address in this last few minutes of my talk is, how do interactions between social organisms determine the spacing behavior that they will take up in a group? Now, first, a little bit of terminology, and I'll try not to belabor this too much, but you can describe a group using a variety of adjectives. When I say cohesive, I mean that they don't just fly apart and disassemble. They're actually a group, and their distances are bounded from above. They like to be together. When I say that they're well-spaced, I mean that they don't just collapse into a tight cluster and sit on top of each other. They like to have their, you know, little distance between one another. I'll also deal with equidistant or uniformly spaced groups, which are a little bit artificial, but they're groups where people or individuals like to more or less be at equal distances apart. And I'll describe two different notions of an individual distance. The first one, the comfortable distance, will refer to two individuals in isolation and how far apart they like to be on average. The individual distance will be that distance when they're kind of packed together in a group and they don't have the freedom to get to their comfortable distance. So delta, this individual distance, will refer to spacing in a larger group. So the basic idea is that the behavior of the spacing is governed by the fact that individuals both are attracted to each other and repelled from each other, and these two effective forces are distance dependent, so that the individuals would like to arrive at a state where those forces roughly are repulsion and attraction exactly balanced. And when that happens, they are then at the comfortable distance. Now it turns out that many people, many ecologists and others, have studied spacings in groups and thought exactly of attraction and repulsion, mainly using inverse power functions to describe the distance dependence of those forces. So you can see that this comes from literature for fish, herds, and other general types of... Yes, absolutely. But you'll see that I'm influenced more by Aristotle. In other words, the model that I'm going to describe, and I'll have only a few minutes to do so, is a model in which I've got xi, the position of the ith individual. X is a vector consisting of all the coordinates x1 through xn, so it holds all the positions. V will be a velocity term, and I'll basically be neglecting inertial forces. I'm not interested in these birds accelerating in a swarm. I'm really interested in slight rearrangements on a wire or in some kind of setting where they're trying to get comfortable spacing between them. And I'm going to assume that that velocity is essentially proportional to the force, to the difference of repulsion and attraction. This is up to some constant factor. I'll just rescale things so that that constant is 1. Furthermore, the force is assumed to be pairwise. So we've got pairwise interactions that depend on distances between the pairs of neighbors. And I've got a linear superposition, which means that each individual somehow is reacting to others, all others in the swarm. But you'll see that because these fall off with distance, really the interaction will not be over very extended, unrealistic spatial range. So typical assumptions about the forces, the magnitude of the interaction should decrease with distance. F should be odd. Again, symmetry arguments will establish this fact. Someone is to your left or to your right. You should either have a positive or a negative velocity, depending on how close they are. And I've dealt with, or I should say we've dealt with, two cases, and I will mainly refer to this one, in which we've got forces that decay exponentially with distance. So the idea is that each individual reacts to its nearest neighbors, next nearest, and so on, but those interactions decay rapidly, exponentially, with distance. We looked first at a simple case in which we've got two organisms and exponential attraction and repulsion with magnitudes capital A and capital R and ranges little a and little r. The velocity in that case is of this form, and it turns out that this is a gradient force, as are many of the forces that have been looked at classically in the table that I showed earlier. Now, we're going to use that fact in a minute, but for the moment, let's just notice that we can define a potential function based on this force. Now, for n equals 2, the distance between these, which will occur when the attraction and repulsion balance, is the same as the minimum of that potential. In other words, it serves as a Lyapunov function for the system, and stable equilibria can be found by looking for that minimum. Well, for that simple case of exponential forces, one can think of 4 possible things that can happen depending on whether the repulsion, shown in red, is bigger always, bigger in some places, or always smaller than the attraction. So those cases basically come out to be as follows. If you look at just a pair of individuals in isolation, so n equals 2, then it's easy to show that there's only one case, namely case number 4, this case right here, in which there's a comfortable distance and that those individuals actually achieve that distance. For other cases, they either fly apart because repulsion dominates, or get closer and closer together because attraction dominates. Moreover, it's very simple to solve for that distance in terms of all the quantities. That's just a trivial calculus problem. In what I talk about further on, I will use this scaling where capital C is the ratio of magnitudes and little l is the ratio of ranges. So what we did next is essentially take this prototype and generalize it so that it deals both with larger swarm sizes and also with arbitrary forces which are of a gradient nature. Now, why gradient forces? Not all interaction forces between social organisms are gradient forces, that's for sure. But if you restrict attention to gradient forces, in other words, if you can express f as the gradient of some function w, then that function serves as a Lyapunov function. In other words, if you find the minima, the local minima of this function, then you're really finding stable configurations of the swarm. So in the case when n is greater than 2, essentially that Lyapunov function consists of a superposition of potentials of pairwise interactions such as the one that I've discussed previously. So we're now studying a model of this sort, but where W is a superposition that includes pairwise interactions of many individuals. Again, you can show that a variety of cases will occur depending on the relative magnitudes and relative ranges of the interactions. And again, case number 4 is really the only biologically relevant interesting case, and that's the case when the range of repulsion is bigger than the range of, the magnitude of repulsion is bigger than that of attraction, and the range and L is also bigger than 1. Here's the definition of C and L up here. Now, let me just show you what you can do in that case. So, here's a simple calculation that shows why exponential gradient forces are simple and easy to deal with. So we're now dealing with the case n greater than 2. So we construct this potential, this Lyapunov function, which consists of this superposition. And let's first look at the case. Let's take a group that we assume to be equidistant. So I'm taking a group and assuming that there is some delta at which they will be arrayed. I'm going to show how to calculate that delta using this formalism. Essentially, it boils down to writing down this superposition and noticing that it is a simple power series in this term and in this term. You can sum those power series so that you can express that Lyapunov function in this closed form, and you can find its local minimum and show that it occurs at some particular spacing distance. Here it is in dimension form. It turns out that that distance is in fact smaller than what we called the pairwise comfortable distance. But it also turns out that in order to have a spacing, in order for these individuals to have finite spacing between them, this term inside here should be positive. And here is an example of the condition for such a well-spaced group. In terms of the different cases that I've explored, the case of the well-spaced group sits in the CL plane, where this is ratio of magnitudes and this is ratio of ranges of attraction and repulsion, sits right about here in this wedge. I want to show a couple of examples. I realize that I'm cutting into the question time, so I'll be fairly brief. A couple of examples of groups which are and are not well spaced, and these are numerical simulations where these are the initial positions of 20 individuals, and this is the same example but with 40 individuals. This is a group that's not well spaced because as you increase n, they tend to get closer and closer together, preserving more the diameter of the group rather than the spacing between the individuals. here is an example of a group which is well-spaced, so where this is satisfied. And what you see here is that, again, initial positions and final positions, time goes along this way in these two panels. What you see is that even when you, this is N20, so when you add organisms, they try very hard to preserve the spacing distance between them so that, roughly speaking, the density is constant in each. You can see that by looking at the final distances between individuals, which in the center of the swarm is roughly 5.9. But you also see that there are edge effects, because on the edges, of course, they're only attracted or repelled from one half, half of the plane, half of the real line, rather. We looked at this also in two dimensions, in simulations, and I don't think I'll have time to show the demo now, but maybe over the break I can show people a demo that shows the redistribution of groups in two dimensions. And it turns out analytically that in higher dimensions, conditions for well-spaced groups look like this. D is the dimension of the space you're looking at. So repulsion has to be quite stronger in this special sense in order for the group to maintain distances between individuals. So I'm coming to the end. I think I've got only a couple more things. Let me summarize some of the things that we showed. Not all of these have I managed to give you much detail about, but these are all things I can refer you to our paper if you're interested. So we generalized also for non-equidistant swarms with arbitrary gradient forces, as long as those forces satisfy certain conditions. Here are some of the results that we got overall. The spacing between individuals in a big swarm is always smaller, they're more tightly packed in, than if it was just a pair in isolation. Cohesion occurs if attraction is larger than repulsion far enough away. The diameter of the group, in that case, is simply going to be some less than some multiple of the comfortable distance. A well-spaced group occurs in general if this condition is satisfied. This is analogous to the inequality I showed earlier, but without assuming exponential forces. In 1D, we've looked at it in this form. In higher dimension, the dimension affects the result. As n increases, the average density is roughly constant, but the size of the swarm will increase. So, finally, what are some challenges and open problems that one could take away and study? We've only discussed spacing, but I think it's very interesting to also say something about the shapes of the swarms in two and three dimensions. In 1D, of course, there's not much else to say, but whether you get a hexagonal packing or some other kinds of packing in 2 and 3D. Generalization to forces that depend not just on distance between individuals, but also on their orientations. Fish and birds have a front and a back. They have some polarization, so the dependence of angle to neighbors may be important. To study the edge effects, to include some stochasticity, to maybe look at swarms where individuals are not necessarily identical. Now, of course, if you include non-gradient forces, and this has been done by many people, including Chad and Andrea, have looked at a variety of other forces, and this is done ongoing work in the literature, the analysis will have to be different, because we've really exploited the fact that for certain gradient forces, you can carry through this Lyapunov function formalism. And to parameterize this for real swarms, to find out what are those interactions, what is the magnitude of repulsion and attraction over distance for real individuals, and to check against spacing behavior in real swarms. So all these are open problems. I'll stop right there. I hope I haven't gone over time too much. And over the break, if anyone's interested, I can show a demo about this. Thank you very much.